Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Over the last several days, we've seen the controversy play out within the Minnehaha County State's Attorney's Office. There's a new batch of FEC reports, and is video and hidden camera footage going to be a popular tool for trying to take down candidates ahead of the 2020 general election? The Dakota Political Junkies are about to bring you a discussion unparalleled in the history of radio, at least if you believe what you read on Twitter. And joining us from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation Studio in Aberdeen, we have John Schaff. He's professor of political science at Northern State University. John, thanks for your assistance in writing today's opener.
I aim for the very platonic ideal of lucidity in this this conversation.
The inside joke is that John's posting on Twitter things that we're pulling for our intro. If you didn't get all that, I'll spell it out for you. On the phone is Argus Leader columnist and investigative reporter Jonathan Ellis. Hey, Jonathan.
Greetings. I just hope I'm in, you know, good radio voice.
Dulcet tones, I'm told. All right, let's talk a little bit. Let's start with the FEC reports, because we have a new, clearer picture of fundraising. John Schaff, kick us off. What have we learned today?
Well, I think what we learned is that most of our members of Congress, as I guess we can get into this a little bit, are doing well in raising money. Dusty Johnson in the last go around, the last quarter, so the last 3 months, which ended on September the 30th, raised $282,000. He's got a little over $400,000 cash on hand. John Thune, who isn't even running for reelection yet, and last two times he ran for reelection, either didn't or essentially didn't have an opponent, has raised $273,000. He has $12.5 million cash on hand, which is a lot. Whereas, interestingly, Mike Rounds, who has a primary challenge and has a relatively recent Democratic challenger, raised over $400,000, which is a good haul, but has only $1.6 million cash on hand, which, for a senator going up for re-election here in just over a year, is, I would say, on the very low end of what you would want to find. I quick looked up a couple of our neighboring states. For example, Jody Ernst in Iowa has $3.4 million cash on hand. Cory Gardner, facing tough re-election in Colorado, has $6.6 million on hand. But even, you know, someone like Ben Sasse in Nebraska, who likely doesn't have much of a challenge for re-election, has $2.7 million. Steve Daines in Montana has $4.1 million cash on hand. Again, another guy who probably is going to face a super tough re-election race. So it's interesting that Rounds is kind of on the low end of that cash on hand, and we'll see if he starts to ramp that up maybe in the next FEC go-around, the next quarterly report.
Hmm. Jonathan Ellis, thoughts on those numbers and the significance of them, especially for Senator Rounds?
Well, you know, I think there are different ways to look at those numbers, and I've actually analyzed, all of his class, the classmates that that were freshmen in 2014, and, you know, he's raised the least amount out of that group, and he has the least amount of cash on hand. That said, he's spent a greater percentage of what he has raised than any of the other candidates. So he's spending faster than any of those other classmates of his. And maybe that's, you know, I've never been in a Senate campaign, but that maybe that's because there are some sort of fixed costs that go with the campaign. I don't know. But so, I mean, I would say that, you know, it shows. I mean, money goes, you know, John mentioned Cory Gardner, and that's going to be a competitive race, and money goes to a lot of, you know, will go to a lot of competitive races. A lot of donors will look at South Dakota and say, well, you know, that's an easy victory for us. But the problem, you know, the problem that kind of ignores recent history, I mean, in Senator Rounds' first election, you know, he didn't raise a ton of money, didn't have a lot of money, and they kind of took the race for granted, and sort of he started deteriorating fairly rapidly in the polls. And if you recall, there was a Democrat, Rick Wyland, and there was also Larry Pressler. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of Democratic money out there that needed a place to go outside of South Dakota. You know, you look at this market, you see somebody starting to struggle in the polls, and, you know, instantaneously, in one night, $2 million of Democratic money showed up, and they just started, you know, hammering Rounds. And so the Republican National Committee had to come in here, National Republican Committees had to come in here and send a bunch of money to South Dakota, which they did not intend to have to do, did not want to do. because they wanted to put the money elsewhere. And so, you know, I think there is an expectation among candidates that, you know, in states like South Dakota, or, you know, if you on the Democratic side, you know, in blue states, that you're going to take care of yourself. And, you know, so I think Senator, these numbers look a little soft, and obviously, you know, he's got some, you know, his wife is, you know, is battling cancer, so there are some extenuating circumstances there. But I think that, you know, I think that some Republicans would look at this number and would certainly like it to be higher.
Mm. And so how does the fact that Skyler Borglum is challenging him in a primary fit into this conversation about money? Because that adds a timeline for expenses. John? I got two Johns. John and Jonathan. John. Professor
Shaw. We're both Johns.
Yes.
So, Skyler Borglum has so far only raised little over $10,000. She's only got $9,000 cash on hand. So that as Jonathan is sort of alluding to, there are two ways of looking at Mike Round's rather low fundraising figures. It might make you nervous because they're not as high as Jonathan says any of his classmates, what you'd expect for someone who up for re-election to have. On the other hand, it might be a sign that he feels very comfortable and he doesn't feel like he's got to be doing a lot of fundraising. And so when you've got a primary challenger who only has, you know, just shy of $10,000 cash on hand, and his Democratic opponent, Mr. Ehlers, who has declared so late he doesn't have anything on file yet. So we'll have to wait and see what he ends up raising. But it could be an indication that he thinks that he's in a very comfortable position and therefore doesn't need to spend a lot of time raising money.
Mm. All right. Jonathan Ellison, Dan Ehlers then, and you talked about the finances and money coming in from the Democratic Party. Well, the state Democratic Party isn't probably going to funnel a lot to Dan Ehlers, but does he have an opportunity to make a case for a nationwide party support? How do you make that case? I mean, is it about vulnerability? Is it about him as a candidacy? John Schaaf, you want to take that one?
I sure will. I think if you look back in history at the incumbent senators in South Dakota who have been defeated for re-election, whether they're Democrat or Republican, usually they get caught up in some sort of national wave that does not redound to their benefit. So we'd have to ask, if you're Dan Ehlers, what can you make of the national situation? And probably if there's going to be an avenue for him to get high enough in the polls that the National Democratic Party is going to pay attention to him, it's going to be, I would guess, that agriculture, the fact that the ag economy is struggling. When we think back to when Jim Abner was first defeated by Tom Daschle back in 1986, it's because we are in the midst of a farm crisis, and there was enough anxiety, and, you know, with the Reagan administration that wasn't doing enough in the eyes of many people to alleviate that crisis, the Republican Jim Abner got defeated by Tom Daschle. You see something similar going on now with the trade issues from the Trump administration. You have the Secretary of Agriculture saying, well, maybe small farms are way of the past. It's get big or get out, which doesn't say a lot to medium and small-sized farmers here in South Dakota. He's basically saying, good luck. We're not going to do anything for you. And these are things I think that a Democratic candidate could use to raise his profile and maybe damage Mike Rounds, who has aligned himself very closely with the Trump administration. The problem that any Democrat in the state of South Dakota has is you have to reach a certain threshold of credibility before people are going to start funneling money your way, whether it's inside the state or outside the state. So it's incumbent upon Dan Ehlers to get to that threshold so he can attain that level of funding. Because right now he's not as strong a candidate as sitting U.S. Congressman Tom Daschle was back in 1986. So he's got kind of a higher threshold that he's got to meet in order to get that sort of funding.
It seems, as I look at some of the things Skyler Borglum has said about Rounds, though, she's going at him not through the idea of, you know, his support of the president, but, I mean, the things that Mike Rounds carries with him from his time as governor are his perceived vulnerabilities. That's what she's saying. So Dan Ehlers has that opportunity, too, as a state lawmaker, to pick at the sweater and try to unravel it of saying, yeah, we're, you know, there are a lot of people who are still not comfortable with some of the scandals and some of the sort of dealings that they perceive make Senator Rounds a vulnerable candidate.
The obstacle they're going to have on that, Lori, is that that was adjudicated very heavily back in 2014, and Mike Rounds came out on top. And so whatever the validity of those complaints might be, in the eyes of many voters, it's going to be, didn't we go through all this in 2014? And so it's a matter of whether you can resurrect something that's already been discussed in public at length 6 years ago. And now we're talking about the Rounds governorship, which is, 10 years ago. There's going to be enough friction there that you can get some, you can get some footing as whether you're Skylar Borglum or Dan Ehlers, can they make anything out of that? And I would suggest that they're probably better off trying to go after something a little bit more recent, but nobody pays me money to run campaigns, so what do I know?
And that farm economy might very well be that recent thing. Let's talk a little bit about that and how that's playing out, because farmers are encouraged, sort of cautiously optimistic about, do we have a trade deal, do we not? Jonathan Ehlers, what do you think the frustration is among farmers as far as just not knowing, and here we are in October?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what they're looking for is some answers and some consistency and some light at the end of the tunnel in trade war. And so, you saw a tweet from the president on Friday sort of announcing that they'd reached this, at least a phase one trade deal in which I think they talked about $40 to $50 billion worth of agricultural goods that China would be buying, which would be huge. But there have been, not a lot of concrete details since then. I mean, there have been plenty of people writing about it, but still nothing has been totally agreed upon. So I think that there would, I think farmers feel like they've been sort of the ones who've taken the brunt of the trade war. And I think that some of them are probably ready for that to be over.
And maybe some of these candidates can make use of that. Maybe not. We will remain to, we'll continue to follow that. I want to shift gears quickly, Jonathan, and talk about state's attorney for Minnehaha County, Aaron McGowan, because you and Joe Sneevy have done a lot of work on this in the Argus Leader, and you haven't been on the Junkies since this all started to unfold. So I'll let you expand on a minute very briefly for people across the state who haven't been following it. Aaron McGowan was absent for a certain time over the summer, as in weeks and weeks, and without really any explanation. There was a 911 call that he says was sort of a check well-being call that ended up being an investigation by Governor Noem and State's Attorney Aaron McGowan. And Jonathan, where do you want to begin with this story? Because Aaron McGowan has also, this is going to transfer into something else we're going to talk about, the relationship with public figures and the media in general. Aaron McGowan said some very strong words about journalism during this time as well. Where do you want to sort of kick off this conversation, Jonathan Ehlers?
Well, we're gonna
chuckle meaningfully for a few minutes. That's what we're gonna do.
Yeah, right. The journalism that we practiced was to get this. I mean, look, we got a tip that Aaron McGowan had disappeared from office, not been in office, and obviously it's our job to ask questions. Why? He's an elected official. The public pays his salary. Okay. And so we started asking some of those questions. We learned that there had been a police call to his house. That call was not on the public logs, which, we expect to see those in the public logs. It was not broadcast over the scanner, which, again, is atypical of how it works. Myself and Joe, and since then Daniel Ferguson, the three of us have been working on this. And Joe and I went out to the neighborhood to try to get details of with neighbors in the neighborhood, did you see police? There was a large police presence on this evening, and Aaron McGowan took exception to that, saying we accosted his neighbors. That's just good journalism to go knock on doors and ask questions, because we got a lot of information that allowed us to confirm what was going on And, you know, the stories we wrote rose to a level that I think the governor had to take notice. It's her job at the end of the day to ensure that law enforcement officials, including state's attorneys, are doing their jobs. And so I think, frankly, I mean, this is, I guess this is my opinion. I think she was put into a position where she didn't have a choice but to ask for the attorney general to investigate what was going on. Why was the guy gone? And so that's what we got. We got the report. She decided to make it public. And most recently, she's decided, you know, pending what we know now, she's not going to initiate legal proceedings to try to remove him from office. And that would have been, you know, while the governor has that ability under state law, there's, you know, some case law that would maybe make it difficult. And so that was the most recent story, you know, we did analyzing the situation. But again, in terms of our doing journalism, that's what we do. We hold public officials accountable. You can't be a public official and disappear from work for 2 months and not answer questions about that.
John Schaaf, your thoughts on how this sort of plays out, because a few people have asked me about it, too. And I think I uttered that same sentence, which was journalists with notebooks knocking on doors is hardly hardly something new. It's sort of the definition of good journalism. What are your thoughts, John Schaaf?
I think when we hear criticisms about journalists today, and I think, you know, we look at national data and there's a lot of distrust of news media. It strikes me that the problem with journalism, to the extent there is not the kind of journalism that Jonathan Ellis and his colleagues are practicing here, where they're actually going out and talking to people and they've got some idea of what's going on, but they want to make sure that they've got all their I's dotted and their T's crossed and that they're actually getting confirmation of things. And to the extent we have a problem with journalism, it tends to be precisely the opposite, that we've had problems of journalists, people in mostly television news media, but some in print, of we run stories way too quickly before we get confirmation, before there's a second source, before you actually know what's going on, because of the desire to get eyeballs and to create sensation. And so if I was going to complain about journalists, it would not be what Jonathan's doing, which is doing due diligence. And so, as I say, you know, knocking on neighbors' doors is not harassing neighbors. It's confirming a story. And so that's what journalists should be doing. And when we do have these public officials who, as Jonathan states, the Mr. McGowan is being paid by the residents of Minnehaha County, and he needs to be held accountable. And apparently it was enough that that the governor looked into it. If there was nothing to it, if it was a nothing story, then the governor and the state attorney general would not have released the report that right. they had. So
and
obviously,
there's
something there.
Right. The things that we learned in the report, you know, are his coworkers describing him as absent and hands off and a figurehead, and there are many other things in that report.
Engaging in unprofessional conduct,
right? Engaging.
So these are things that the public needs to know, whether it's coming from an official source like the Attorney General's office or from an unofficial source like the Argus Leader. This is what we pay both of those entities, whether it's tax money or subscription money. This is what we want these people to be doing.
But here's one of the things I'm curious about is this narrative, because, you know, Aaron McGowan said he welcomed clearing the air with the investigation. He's, you know, released a public statement saying, I've got nothing to hide. You know, of course, the investigation will be fine. That's not the tack he took with journalism. He said, you know, I'm not going to speak to the Argus Leader anymore. He had a very different sort of approach. And that sort of plays into kind of what we're seeing in politics a lot right now, is public officials saying, you know, taking a shot at journalists and journalism to some pretty extreme, you know, to some pretty extreme levels. Just another day at work, Jonathan Ellis?
I think to some extent it is. I mean, you know, and I agree with John that I think that abuses that we see, if that's the right word, in journalism or bad journalism often takes place in the television medium. And I
I think we might have just lost Jonathan.
It's sort of suspicious, right? That that right when he's about to, censorship. No, I'm kidding.
I blame the deep state.
There is a problem with the phone, and we will leave it there, and we'll have that conversation again in the future. John Schaaf, thank you so much for being here, and we appreciate Jonathan Ellis's time as well. You can read all his coverage of the situation with state's attorney Aaron McGowan on the Argus Leader's website, argusleader.com.